Right now, what I do know is it's time to bring in David Terechuk. It's time for The Media Beat. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. David also is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He's been a very good, busy guy about ethics and belief lately. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good to be back with you. Coming into you from the media capital of the world, as befits this slot on media discussion. And what's it like in Connecticut? Are you insulated from the craziness of the East Coast?
We had no up here. We had a huge amount of rain in a short amount of time, but then we had wind gusts of above 45 to 50 miles an hour and steady winds from about 25 to 30 miles an hour. And literally yesterday, schools were closed because so many crews, there were so many down trees, tree limbs, telephone poles, and power lines that, you know, it was just, it was a mess. But I'll give, you know, all the people that work for the power company and all the people that work for the state and the town crews, they got out and they managed to, if they couldn't fix everything right away, they managed to cone it off and set up detours. But this morning, everything looks pretty normal. So I give those folks a lot of credit. They work into the late at night in the worst conditions.
Yeah, around New York, it was pretty much the same. But here in the actual heart of it all, in the city itself, the winds were whistling down these concrete canyons of ours. But that's about all.
That's enough. Just on a normal windy day, sometimes it's tough to fight them.
That's true. The microclimate can get pretty windy in any case, yeah.
All right. Well, once again, we've been jabbed in the abdomen by two stories that we've been following for it seems, forever.
And that is exactly how it feels.
And those two stories are impeachment and the president and also Brexit. Well, I want to start off with Brexit because when it was announced that there was a deal between the EU and Britain with Brexit, it sounded very good, but then all of a sudden there were some MPs that chimed in, and then the Scottish court is reviewing a bid now to declare this illegal. So in your opinion, because you can follow it a lot with a lot better knowledge and a better lay of the land, where do you think it stands and where do you think it's going?
Well, the British media have been mixed, as always, in their reaction. One of the most obsequious responses, though, came from Piers Morgan. I don't know if you remember him, but he had media career here in the States after Larry King came off the air with his long-running show on CNN. That didn't last too long, and Piers is back in Britain as a media personality, I guess that's the best way to describe him. And his comment is somewhat typical of a certain stretch of a certain extent of the political landscape in Britain. He says, "Looks like Boris has done it." This is a tweet from Piers Morgan. "Looks like Boris has done it. Well done, Prime Minister." It's hard to read this stuff. "Well done, Prime Minister. You held your nerve, played the no-deal card superbly." That's an interesting bit of analysis. "And got a deal. The British public won't forget or forgive Parliament if it now fails to vote for what seems a very sensible compromise. Do it and move on." So that's one end of the spectrum. Generally speaking, though, I mean, roaming more widely across the media, at least, you now get a sense of there being, well, over a big, we're over, get a sense of us being over a big hurdle, but we're by no means over the problem. The Guardian's headline, for instance, is "Johnson gets his Brexit deal, and now it's a numbers game." The numbers, of course, are whether or not he can get this deal through Parliament, and that's very far from certain.
Well, because he's got the Labour Party, but also, do you think that the problem, once again, with Scotland is the thing that could scuttle this? Because they don't appear happy at all.
Well, there's many parts of the country are just not happy at all. The basic problem right from the beginning in 2015, is that there is no real consent. There is no popular consensus. There is no parliamentary consensus. What we saw in the results of that referendum is that while the heart of England, as it were, and in particular the regional, the not so much the regional heart, but the geographical center of the country, the big extent of what is often called Little England, which is at the heart of Great Britain, was the core of Brexit feeling, of wanting to leave Europe. Other areas and areas within England too, most particularly what's often called the sophisticated cosmopolitan center of London, is very much in favor of staying in Europe. And interestingly, almost the entire length and breadth of Scotland were absolutely in favor of staying in Europe and voted against Brexit in that referendum. So yeah, I mean, that's what's the unchanging part of the landscape. Scotland doesn't want to leave, and many parts of Britain that count as centers of some sophistication, I suppose, some sense of us being a part of an international alliance. It's the small-minded, I mean, I'm betraying my own prejudice here, but it's the small-minded kind of thinking that goes with that Little England concept, the essentially xenophobic and in many ways racist view of a lot of English people, I'm afraid, that Europe is full of foreigners and we shouldn't be attached to them. It's as crude as that sometimes when you boil it down. But yeah, Scotland remains as a problem, and of course, virtually all of Scotland's MPs will feel that tug to vote against this deal, and many more people of the Labour Party simply because it's Johnson's deal and they want him out, and a lot of people who feel that it isn't the good deal that is being bandied around now, and there are reasons for having suspicions about this deal too. I mean, it does. I mean, just in terms of the historical development of it, it does have a remarkable similarity to a deal that Theresa May brought back to Parliament at least 2 years ago. And it was then shouted down, and then Theresa May, of course, had to go back to Europe, you know, more than once thereafter, and ended up failing completely and having to resign. So it's not necessarily a great deal, and it's not by any assured measure at all a deal that can get through Parliament tomorrow, when very unaccustomedly Parliament will meet on a Saturday in order to take this vital vote.
Is there any chance that if this is approved, that it'll once again rekindle in Scotland the desire to be independent?
Oh, more than a chance. That such an outcome was guaranteed to fuel demands for independence for Scotland, and then, you know, in the long run, what those Scottish independence idealists would think is that then an independent Scotland could then apply to Europe for membership on its own. Screw the English. We'll go in as our own members of Europe. That has become an even stronger feeling among Scots than it was when they had their, I should say we had our, because I'm Scottish myself. We had our referendum back in the earlier part of this decade, and it would be a perfect campaigning opportunity for the Scottish National Party, the ones who really bang the drum for independence, to demand another referendum of the same kind, but this time with all the resentment that has built up of being ignored. This is what Scotland has been been ignored in the arrangements with, you know, trying to get a deal on Britain's position vis-a-vis Europe.
All right. And then, of course, as John Oliver always says now on his show, stupid Watergate 2. Let's go back to the United States. That's what John Oliver is calling all this. Stupid
yes,
Watergate.
Yes, you don't see quite so much obsequiousness in the American media in response to Trump's developments this last week. What with Turkey, what with impeachment, what with administration members basically admitting to the whole quid pro quo idea that, that he got Ukraine to intervene in our elections by getting them to investigate his political opponents.
You know,
in return to getting them, excuse me, in return for getting their military aid money restored.
You know, I watched the press conference yesterday with Mulvaney, and I was stunned about two things. First of all, by trying to throw this back to the 2016 elections. No, the request was made specifically with the Biden's name in it. But on top of that, what's interesting about what's going on with what Mulvaney said on that press conference was the first thing. But then the second thing, he basically told the media to get over it. This is politics. This is the way foreign policy is handled. And in one way, he's right. Foreign policy between the United States as a government as a whole, and that's a government as a whole, does hold the string out to foreign governments to give them support in exchange for something. But that's
sure.
That's
America has a lot of muscle to flex when it comes to less powerful countries, and it's often in financial terms and not afraid of using it.
No,
that's a bit of real politics you can't get away from.
No,
but to use those same strong arming methods to gain a political advantage in a forthcoming election, that's a different matter.
That's exactly the difference. It's no longer, because if Donald Trump had gone through his State Department and had gone through Congress and the Senate and come up with a proposal on behalf of the country, that's one thing. But to name Rudy Giuliani to get a few people together and then go after on a personal basis as the President of the United States is the big thing. And
yeah, it's a big thing, and to do it so covertly, kind of, except that it would all come out in the end, covertly, through, of all people, his own personal lawyer. What a great lawyer he is, too. Rudy Giuliani is such evidence of an ulterior motive, at the least. And one could, and people do, of course, describe it as many people do describe it as a corrupt motivation. The very ambassador to Europe who was directed by Trump to get involved in this Ukrainian scheme, Gordon Sondland, the billionaire hotel owner who has bought his position and his involvement in this by contributing $1 million to the Trump campaign, or at least to the Trump inauguration celebrations, has got himself into a terrible pickle here, and he, you know, he's the one. Well, he's one of several, but he most pointedly said how awful it was to be involved in this scheme of Trump's and find that he had to deal with Rudy Giuliani as part of that, and he was very clear in his submission to the House impeachment investigation. He's a complete Trump creation in a sense. I mean, he's a Republican donor who threw his lot in with Trump very early on, paid the $1 million, as I say. Oh, and incidentally, got a hold of $1 million of the public purse to make expensive alterations to his ambassadorial residence in Europe. So, you know, there's an interesting form of ledger keeping, isn't it? You contribute $1 million to a politician for as reward, you get a position in which you have $1 million of public money spent on your house.
What's the old song? Nice and the wheel go around and around.
don't let's forget Nikki Haley's curtains.
No, but still, the winner of all was the congressperson, the one-term congressperson who just totally, I think he spent $200,000 in his first year redoing his office in Washington, yeah. But also redoing an office locally, and then, of course, using the charge card for vacations and stuff like that. But it's just,
there's a level of oversight that's required on a lot of people. But it's not that good.
As you were saying earlier, none of this is exactly new in the world of politics. But I think the intensity of it and the consistency of it, I suppose, across the breadth.
Well, actually, Marshall
said breadth of the Trump administration's operations is awesome. I think
Marshall says something really interesting, though. I don't know to whom, but if politics weren't a profession, but rather an act of service where you went in for...
Well, like it used to be. You went and served your 2 years, your 4 years, and then you went back to your farm, you went back to your business, and you ran it.
And you had a much better sense. And what is combination of alarming and, using the president's word here, sorry, sad, is how puppet-like the media has now become. Around, what happened to the independent thought? Jam it, it's like let's stick that little, cattle prod in this concept and make people think about it. Instead of, we've got such, everything is as bad as the last thing is as bad as the last thing. And while, as you put it, certain people are literally affected by this on a daily level, you've got an entire layer that is just in the midst of a massive yawn.
I don't know. I'll give credit to the media. Yesterday, there were two female reporters and one male reporter that weren't getting direct answers. And it almost reminded me of Sam Donaldson when he used to shout at Reagan, "Mr. President!" And the president would stop and make the mistake of stop, and Donaldson would just pound him till he got an answer. This happened three times. Now, they didn't get an answer, and this is where Nick Mulvaney is such a smooth guy. He goes, "I'm going to answer your question, but you're not going to like the answer." It was, he said that more than three times, and I said to myself, that's a great setup line.
That worked perfectly. It worked as well as when during the debate, which notice no one's talking about. remember that? That happened 2 days ago.
Yeah, I remember it well, yes.
That was, how long ago was that? 48, 72 that hours?
Was, yeah, 72 hours ago, yeah.
Okay, yawn, yeah. Right? So that as a line was almost as good as, people have certain verbal, they're not ticks as much as they are time fillers.
Well, no, I
of
just
course.
Deflectors.
Yeah, it was interesting to watch. But I give them a question. They kept going back and back and back, and he just wouldn't budge. But
we're with Mulvaney, though. The interesting thing is that sure, he could put on a good performance of refusing to be goaded into giving a totally truthful answer. And then, of course, realizing that he'd given too much away anyway.
That's exactly right.
Two hours later, he tries to unsay what he so clearly had said in the press conference.
Because he got a call.
Of course, he obviously had the word come down from Trump himself.
Yeah,
toe the line again.
Yeah, you know what happened. I'm struck. I haven't read this yet, Marshall. Maybe you have. But Axios is calling it the shout-out strategy. Do we know what that means?
Oh, you must making clear that everybody knows that you're doing everything that you're accused of doing slyly on the quiet. You say, "Can't be wrong because I'm prepared to talk about it out loud."
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's taking something. It's almost as bad, but not quite as bad as the alternate reality, the alternate truth that was mentioned back when in the inauguration days. This is an alternate truth. There is no alternate truth. Well,
That's not new either, because Karl Rove was the one when he was credited at the time as only an anonymous spokesperson for the Bush administration, but the W. Bush administration, that is. But he used the phrase, we create our own reality. and that's what's happening all over again, Yogi Berra.
and so the question becomes, and this is getting harder and harder for people to realize that, here's the split. People who know what's going on know what's going on. People who don't know what's going on, and there's a whole group of...
That's always been the case. But that's always been the case.
And the people who don't know aren't getting the necessary help in knowing and understanding what's going on from the people who ought to do that job.
It is the
media. Right?
It is worse now because you have media lined up in different courts, which it never never used to be that way. They didn't line up behind.
That's what I
they
was.
Had. They had writers and they had reporters. They had columnists.
And there was some
that varied back and forth.
Attempt at impartiality.
But now that's not the case. There's one side of the ball and there's the other side of the
ball.
But
that's turning it into a team sport, the Reds and the Blues, so to speak, may be more interesting. I'm just making that. Pick your whatever. But it changes the dynamic when it comes to critical thinking. It just does. It can't help but. So,
well, it sidelines critical thinking is essentially what happens. You get the Reds and the Blues and the supposed team spirit that's generated that makes critical thinking irrelevant to the process.
Then if you take one of the sides, like, for example, let's go back to the Democratic debates, you know, the thing that wasn't on or should have been on, you would think MSNBC 48 hours ago and wasn't, was that of the three perceived front runners, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden, it was Sanders who had the most money at $33 million.
Well, it's not only that. You know, MSNBC did a whole thing on the debate, and they mentioned everybody but guess who? Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders scares media people, because they don't understand exactly what he's trying to do with his political revolution. But it was very interesting to see the Democrats on that stage, and I did watch it for the first time, and I was very impressed with Klobuchar. I was impressed with the way Bernie handled it and the way Bernie covered Elizabeth Warren. The progressive wing on that party, the DNC, I hope they don't make the mistake that they've got to find a way to give the progressive wing a voice, because if you look at all the poll numbers, the moderates have about 38% of the vote so far in this early season, and the progressive side of the wing has almost has 60-some percent. So the DNC has got to find a way to give the progressive wing of the party some more of a voice. Otherwise, it could be a disaster come 2020.
Yeah, and what was interesting too is that out of those perceived front runners, it was Elizabeth Warren who was the focus for everybody's critical attention, those on the platform at least, and it was reflected to some degree in the moderator's insistent questioning, and she was in one of those difficult positions where. She could only, or apparently because of her coaching and her repeated rehearsing, I think, able to come up with only one repeated answer to a question that everybody else was. Bernie in particular, Bernie had the virtue at least of being very clear about how he intends to pay for the very ambitious scheme of Medicare for all. He makes it, bluntly very clear that, of course, taxes are going to have to go up. That's a political reality. Whereas Warren got herself into a chiming, repeating refrain that wouldn't budge off a kind of non-denial denial, saying that her answer would be that costs were not going to go up for middle class people, but never directly answered the question about whether it meant that middle class people's taxes would go up.
And that's the whole.
She's going to have to change that way of tackling this question from now on, because it's clearly an evasion. And it was shown to be so in that debate format.
And she
one of the few things that did come out clearly from that format, I believe.
And she should have learned. Bernie Sanders has been talking about his program for 5 years now, and when people say,
I wrote the damn bill. I wrote the damn thing. Yeah.
But what's interesting about it is when people ask him about it, isn't it going to raise taxes? This is what I love about Bernie. He hits you over the head with the hammer and says, of course, you idiot, it's going to raise taxes. But here's what you're not going to spend on. You're not going to have a deductible.
Exactly, yeah. And Elizabeth Warren could have said that too, but she kept on this parroted refrain of costs are not going to go up for the middle class.
And I wonder about her handlers, because this is where I wonder about people's attachment to understanding of actual voters. And Marshall is saying 2 minutes, because it's abundantly clear. Anyone, doesn't really matter what your party is, needs is, yes, of course that's going to happen. You nitwit. I mean, because they go out every day and they have to live, you know. Is that price going to go up? Yeah, that price is going to go.
As I've said time and time again about my very first boss in our business, is that you must never underestimate the intelligence of your audience.
but don't overestimate.
I think these politicians are underestimating our capacity to understand that, of course, taxes are going to go up when you have a very ambitious program like this. But what else is going to happen to justify that or to balance that out?
You know, what's funny about this, American voters don't mind hearing somebody give a response that they might not believe, okay, or trust. But they definitely don't like a response that is a non-response, and that's what's amazing, that these campaigns can't figure it out. You know, come up with your answer. It might be the answer that everybody likes, but it's going to be the answer that people back you like. So just give the answer.
Yep.
All right. Well, you know, that's it, unfortunately. So we're going to just have to wait till it comes Friday again.
It will, soon enough.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.
Thank you.
Of course, you can hear the Media Beat with David here on a Friday live, and also rebroadcast on the weekend, during the
Monday.
On Monday at 12, I think it's 12:04, or is it 12? Here on Robin Hood Radio.